Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
Now, today we're starting off a brand new series, but before I get into anything about that, I want to read scripture together. So if you would, wherever you are, if you're able, would you stand out of respect for the word of God? Just stand. And I want to read to you from the Apostle Paul's letter to the church in Ephesus, chapter 4. Verses 14 through 16. In this passage, Paul tells the church what a unified and mature church looks like in Christ. It's a powerful word. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 14, Paul writes, "We must no longer be children, tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness in deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth in building itself up in love." This is the word of the Lord. You can be seated. Thanks for standing, and thanks be to God for all of his word. Now, today we are starting off a brand new sermon series on a topic that I've preached on frequently over the last couple years, but this series is going to get me an opportunity to dive a little deeper in it. We're starting a new series today called Voices. Voices. You can show them the diagram. Here's the underlying premise of the series. The voices that we listen to most often and intently are the voices that disciple you. They're the voices that disciple me. Over time. From the people who raise you, to the friends you surround yourself with, to the places that you live, to the apps that you give your attention to the news outlets you prefer, to the shows or sports you entertain yourself with, to the celebrities you admire, to the organizations that employ you, to the brands you patronize, to the art you consume, to the politicians that you follow. All of these entities are voices. And they're all speaking into your life. And they're trying to answer some of life's big questions, like what's right and what's wrong? What's broken in this world? What are the solutions to fix what's broken in this world? What's the key to human flourishing? What's the key to a good life? And depending on what voices you tune your ears to, they will shape you and they will form you. If, for example, were you raised in the South? I was. I'll tell you what, if you were raised in the South, they have very specific answers that you were shaped into these questions. Maybe you were raised in the home of a Democrat. There are very specific answers to these questions. You were told a specific story. Let's say you watch the NBA. Every time you turn it on, you are being told what's right and what's wrong in the world. Let's say you work for, you know, GE or Ford here in town. I'm telling you, when you live in those organizational cultures, they shape you. They form you over time. So Christian Smith is a sociologist, Christian sociologist at Notre Dame. If you've never heard of him before, you should, especially if you're like a nerd and a Christian and into sociology, because he writes some really, really important stuff. In fact, he wrote a book recently called Moral Believing Animals, because that's what he believes we human beings are. Basically, in this book, he makes the case that human beings, by nature, we have to have a overarching macro story that explains life, that explains our origins and our destiny and our existence and morality that we can lean into. Now, all of us don't necessarily have to have the same macro story, but ever since the beginning of time, our most ancient ancestors, we all need a story to live into. This is what he writes. Smith says, we not only continue to be animals who make stories, but also animals who are made by our stories. Fascinating. So we tell and retell narratives that themselves come fundamentally to constitute and direct our lives. We, every bit as much as the most primitive or traditional of our ancestors, are animals who most fundamentally understand what reality is, who we are, and how we ought to live by locating ourselves within larger narratives that we hear and tell, and that constitute what is for us real and significant. Now, if that sounds like just a bunch of sociological jargon for you, in one of his chapters, Professor Smith actually lays out for us seven examples of the most powerful and impactful macro stories that most of us live into or resist over the last couple hundred years in the modern West. He sort of lists them out for you. I want to read these seven to you in order to kind of help you understand how we're shaped. Okay. The first one's called the American Experiment Narrative. This story says that the USA is an experiment in freedom and democracy, ordained by God, that must be spread around the world and defended with our lives. Now, some of you already are like, well, Tyler, of course, that's just true. You know, it's just what it's not a story. That's what the truth is. Well, I'm not saying it's true or false. What I'm saying is that that was a story that you were shaped by, likely, if you grew up in the United States of America. Here's another one. It's called the Militant Islamic Resurgence Narrative. This narrative says that Islam has awoken. All believers must submit themselves to Allah and devote their lives to jihad to drive out the infidels at home and abroad. Now, chances are most folks watching right now don't live into this narrative. In fact, most people who practice Islam do not live into this narrative. However, this narrative has been profoundly impactful on the West, especially in the last 20 to 30 years. Here's another example. This is called the capitalist prosperity narrative. Very, very impactful. This story says that the economic system, that is capitalism, has produced more wealth and well-being than any other ever could. We must fight off leftist utopian egalitarians, government regulators, and lazy freeloaders. Or how about this next one, the progressive socialism narrative? Again, very impactful over the last couple hundred years in the West. This narrative says we must abolish private property, socialize production, and distribute goods according to need, not buying power, and we'll have to defeat the right-wing billionaires to do it. There's the scientific enlightenment narrative that says science will be our salvation. We can relieve human suffering and prolong life. But the forces of fear, irrationality, superstition, and blind religiosity hold us back. Or how about this next one? The expressive romantic narrative. Free thinkers who shed the domesticating restraints of society, get in touch with their emotions, and act on their desire are those who discover their deepest selves and an authentic life. That's six. There's a seventh. You probably recognize this one, the Christian narrative. This narrative says that God created humanity for loving fellowship. Humanity sinned. God became human and delivered us from sin through Jesus' death and resurrection, and those who respond experience eternal life. Now, a quick review slide here. I want you to see all of them. Okay, and here's Smith's points. There are millions of voices out there telling us thousands of macro and micro stories. But the reason he points out these seven is because he wants you to realize how these stories shape us. They shape us in profound ways. And I guarantee you on that list right there, there are a few that you could circle that say, I've been taught to embrace these. And there's a few that you could circle where you'd say, I've been taught to resist these. But the point is that we've all been taught. There are voices in our life. They shape us with the stories that they tell us, and that creates a moral universe, if you will, that we live within. Now, there are a few rules of how these work that Smith lays out in the rest of his book. I think these are important. One, he says very few people are purists. Lots of people like to say, I'm a purist when it comes to, I only live into the Christian narrative. Very few people do. For most of us, it's kind of syncretistic and we have a lot mixed together too. He says, we all think that our way is perfectly rational, like it's the right way, when really it isn't. Very few of us have a completely coherent worldview, and all the major worldviews have some holes in them where they need to do a little work. And then last, he makes this point, and this is a critical one. He says, these stories matter. They matter deeply, they matter profoundly. They actually make us or break us. The voices you listen to, the stories you believe, the moral universe you embrace, it matters, because at the end of the day, it's what impacts your life and how you choose to live. So I have a few questions for you today, if you're still with me after that sociology rabbit trail. Question. What voices are you listening to? You. What stories are they telling you? And what moral universe are they giving you? And how do you know if they're right or wrong? How do you know where they're wrong? Well, let's take that one step further. What voices should you be listening to? Should I be listening to? These are all extremely important questions, and that's the outline for our series coming up. Just kind of work backwards here. In week 3 and in week 4 of the series, we're going to talk about what voices we should be listening to, the voice of God, and how to tune into that. Next week, in week 2 of the series, we're going to talk about how to discern false prophets, how to discern the spirit, how to tell the difference between truth and lies and the voices that are out there. But this week, I want to start by hopefully bringing just some self-awareness to the question and calling you to reflect. What voices are you allowing to shape your life? What stories are you believing? What moral universe are you embracing? Now, I want you to know that on that note, I believe Christianity tells the best story. We have the best one out there. It makes the most emotional sense. It makes the most rational sense. And the best way to sort of assimilate yourself into the Christian story is to listen to the voice of God. Here's the only problem, though. While a majority of America still calls themselves Christians, a majority of those Christians are pretty apathetic when it comes to the actual Christian story, and they don't listen to the voice of God all that much. And even for those of us who do, who like show up at church and want to read our Bibles and try to pray and do all the things, you know, even for those of us who do, we're pretty undisciplined when it comes to tuning into God's voice, and we're always distracted in our culture by alternative stories. Now, you know who's eaten our lunch when it comes to telling their story? PR firms. The voices, if you will, that are behind the politicians and the special interest groups and the major brands that are out there today. They are eating our lunch, y'all. Okay, now, their stories are not better than our story. The Christian story is the best one, but they sure are better at telling their story. And they invest millions of dollars and countless hours into telling those stories in compelling ways that grab us. You ever notice how it's literally impossible to escape the constant messaging and advertising out there? I mean, first off, we got these little pocket screens that we carry with us everywhere that are constantly messaging us. And then when we finally put those down at the end of the day, we've got our bigger screens that are literally our TV room. Our TV room is organized around that we focus on. And then if somehow we can get away from those screens, there's like billboards on the side of the road, yard signs, mail-in flyers. There's screens on the gas station, gas pump. There's screens in the bathroom at BW3s, and constantly we're being messaged to. Did you know that the average American today gets advertised to, they see more ads in 1 year than the average American 50 years ago did in an entire lifetime? That is astounding, and you better believe that is impacting our minds and our beliefs. Did you know that the average American today spends 11 hours on average, again, 11 hours a day on screens? And if you subtract out of that the time that you're at work, most of that recreational time is either on social media accounts, streaming services, or watching TV. You better believe that's shaping our minds. So have you ever heard of Edward Bernays? We got a picture of the good old boy here. So Bernays is actually the nephew of Sigmund Freud, famous psychologist. Bernays is the modern father of public relations. What he did was he took his uncle's insights about human psychology and he leveraged them in order to manipulate people through public relations. In fact, in 1928, he wrote a book called Propaganda. And I want to read you an excerpt from it because he gives us a peek behind the curtain of what these public relations gurus are able to do. Bernays writes, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society, don't miss this, constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. An invisible government. We are governed. Our minds are molded. Our tastes formed. Our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. Whew, that's kind of diabolical if you really read through that with me. Okay, so what is Bernays saying? Bernays is saying behind the brands, behind the interest groups, behind the politicians, behind them is an invisible government that understands us better than we understand us and manipulate us through clever PR schemes, ads, and messaging. And understand, he wrote this in 1928. Fast forward 100 years later and look at the technologies, the data collection, and algorithms available today. And it is astounding. It's astounding what they know about us and how well they are at appealing to us. So they do this today through the use of what they call surveillance technology. Surveillance technology, or systemically, it's called surveillance capitalism. It's a term coined by Shoshana Zuboff. She's a Harvard Business School professor. This is what surveillance technologies are. They're technologies you welcome into your life because they aid your lifestyle, provide convenience, or offer entertainment. All the while, they gather detailed personal data about you and then analyze it with sophisticated algorithms in order to predict your behavior so they can pitch goods and services tailored to your preferences. So understand, this isn't like George Orwell's 1984 Big Brother. This isn't the government coming into your house and making you install a screen that you have to watch propaganda on and that like spies on you in your home. It's a softer form of totalitarianism, if you will. These are technologies that we accept. These are technologies that we want, that we spend exorbitant amounts of money on in order to have, because they make our lives easier. And yet at the same time, they are data collection devices so that we can be formed and we can be shaped. Don't believe me? Just think about an average day in the life. All right, let me walk you through one. So you wake up in the morning, the alarm goes off, and you go for a run, right? And as you go for a run, once you're done, your Fitbit or your Whoop band uploads all of your workout stats and your vitals to the owner of the app. You get home, you eat breakfast. While you're eating breakfast, you answer a couple emails. And as you're on your Gmail account, Google literally scans every word that you type in for keywords in order to direct advertising at you later. Then you jump on Facebook or some other social media channel. And as you're on there, everything you like, everything you click on, everything you comment, everything you share is again recorded by Facebook and then monetized as they build a personal profile on you. And their algorithms are so sophisticated that they are able to predict your mental well-being. They're able to predict your stage of life. They're able to predict your political leanings. They basically know you better than you know you. After that, you get on a news website or a blog of some sort and you start reading stories. And the cookies in your browser then report back everything that you look at and you read. Then you drive to work, and as you drive to work, the sensors that you've literally plugged into your car report your driving habits back because you want a cheaper car insurance. And oh, by the way, the location services on the apps on your phone also report back your location as you move around your day, allowing some folks to geo-target you with ads. All the requests you make of your digital assistant Siri throughout the day, recorded and monetized. The words you say at your home, in the earshot of Alexa, recorded and monetized. I kid you not, last week, one of my buddies, Nate, was in here and he was volunteering for our weekend services. And he texted me later that day and he says, Tyler, I'm not an Enneagram guy. But as soon as I got home from church, I started getting Enneagram ads on Instagram. And he sent me a screenshot of it. Why? Because his phone sat through our church service and two services in a row, they got to hear me talk about the Enneagram. Oh, and it wasn't just any Enneagram, it was on Enneagram 3s. Why? Because I'm an Enneagram 3 and I talked about it. Is that insane? Everywhere you go and use your credit card, whether it's at the grocery store or a restaurant, it's recorded and monetized. Your smart refrigerator, your smart TV, your smart security system, it's all gathering and monetizing data. And then you set your alarm at the end of the day, put your phone down, and that data is uploaded. All your previous day's activities to your apps and rinse, recycle, repeat. Now you see here, see how this works? And with this wealth of information, the invisible government, Bernays calls it, knows more about you than you know about you. Did you actually know that there's a debate going on in the world of church right now about how to utilize big data? There are big data firms that are actually offering their services to churches, and churches are split on it. Some churches say, well, that feels kind of manipulative. We shouldn't be using that in order to, you know, target and manipulate people. But then other churches are like, the heck we shouldn't. We've got the greatest story ever told, and we have to fight back against the manipulation that other organizations are utilizing. Well, what a crazy time to be alive. Now, if it wasn't sad enough that this constant onslaught of sophisticated distraction and messaging wasn't impacting us, what makes it even sadder is that it's destroying our young people, particularly our teenagers, who are as exposed to it as us, if not more. In 2017, a cover story in The Atlantic, Gene Twainy, a psychologist, wrote an article called How the Smartphone Destroyed a Generation. In her article, she makes the case that around 2012, she's basically a psychologist who studies the differences between generations. She said in 2012, they saw a spike in many concerning issues among teenagers, like mental illness, like antisocial behavior, like extended adolescence. And her theory in this article, based on the data that she found, is the reason why 2012 was the spike year, if you will, is because that was the year that the American population moved past 50% ownership of smartphones. Here's your argument in the article. She says, even when a seismic event, like a war, a technological leap, or a free concert in the mud, plays an outsized role in shaping a group of young people, no single factor ever defines a generation. Parenting styles change, so do school curricula and culture, and these things matter. But the twin rise of the smartphone and social media has caused an earthquake of a magnitude we've not seen in a very long time, if ever. There is compelling evidence that the devices we've placed in young people's hands are having profound effects on their lives and making them seriously unhappy. She goes on to quote several statistics from her study. I just want to fire through several of them here. And you may have seen these in your circles. First, she says rates of teen depression and suicide have skyrocketed since 2011. iGen is on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. Much of this deterioration can be traced to their phones. Teens are less likely today to leave the house without their parents. Did you know that? 12th graders in 2015 were going out less often than 8th graders did as recently as 2009. Today's teens are less likely to date as well. Only 56% of high school seniors in 2015 went on a date, which compare that to boomers and Xers is about 85%. Nearly all boomer high school students had their driver's license by the spring of their senior year, but more than 1 in 4 teens today still lack one at the end of high school. Now, one of the ironies of all this is that with iGen kids being at home more often, they're not going on dates, they don't got their license, etc. One of the ironies is that they're not actually closer to their parents, even though they're under the same roof. Why? Because they're on their screens. She goes on, she says, the number of teens who get together with their friends nearly every day dropped by more than 40% from 2000 to 2015, which means not only are they not closer to their parents, but they're not closer to their friends either. And most of these in-person hangouts were replaced by hangouts in digital spaces. Now, you might expect, since teens spend so much time in digital spaces, they do it because they actually like to be there. But that's not been the case either. She goes on to show that teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy. While the reverse is true, those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. To conclude, she points out that the smartphone is cutting into teens' sleep. Many now sleep less than 7 hours most nights. Now, sleep experts say that teenagers need to get 9 hours or more a night to be healthy. A teen who's operating on 7 hours or less is significantly sleep deprived. Yet 57% more teens were sleep deprived in 2015 than in 1991. Wow. So in summary, this is what Twenge concludes. She says, if you're going to give advice for a happy adolescence based on our data, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone, turn off the laptop, and do something that doesn't involve a screen. You know what's fascinating about this crisis that we're facing as parents? What's fascinating is that the challenge of parents in this generation is not to teach their kids how technology works. Their kids know. Your kids will teach you. And it's also not to teach kids how to find information. They have a world of information at their fingertips and YouTube and Google and all the things. No, the challenge of parenting is to make sure your kids don't get addicted while they work on technology and to help them curate healthy sources of information as they live on the web. So I said it earlier, let me say it again. The voices we listen to matter. The voices you listen to most often intently are the voices that will shape you. They're the voices that will disciple you over time. The voices we listen to, the stories we believe, the moral universes we embrace and our kids embrace, they matter deeply to our lives. I want to show you a picture. This is a picture taken in 1936 in Nazi Germany. It's the harbor of Hamburg as a Nazi naval vessel is christened and sent off. And as you can see, all the workers in the crowd are giving the infamous Sieg Heil, a sign of loyalty to Hitler and the Nazi party. Well, all of them except for one man there in the crowd. You see him cross-armed? August Landmesser. That's interesting. If you read the story of August Landmesser, what you'll find is that from the year 31 to 35, Landmesser was a part of the Nazi party. This picture was taken in 36. Clearly, he's a resistor at this point. So what happened between 35 and 36? Well, he met a girl. And he fell in love. And she was a Jewish girl. And so he had a new voice in his life, a new story that he believed into, a new moral universe that he embraced. The Nazi party would not allow him and his love to be married, at least not legally by law. And so in 1936, you see the beginning of his resistance, which eventually destroyed his life. His resistance eventually landed him in prison, his wife in a concentration camp. And yet 80 years later, his resistance is an inspiration. How? How did he end up the one in the crowd who wouldn't salute? I'll tell you how. The voices you listen to, the stories you believe, the moral universe you embrace matters. I'll show you another picture. You'll recognize this one. This is a picture of Jake Angeli, the Q shaman who was a part of the group that stormed the Capitol on January 6th. As a young man, Jake desired to be a performer. He wanted to be an actor, be in the limelight, be someone who was recognizable. And as he grew into adulthood, he became more and more attracted to far right-wing conspiracies about what was broken in the world and how to fix it. Eventually, he became a disciple of Q, the QAnon conspiracy source online. And so, on January 6th, he put on his fur headdress, painted his body with white, red, and blue war paint, carried a 6-foot spear with an American flag on it, and he stormed our Capitol. Now, Angeli's being charged by the federal government, and in a January 14th federal filing, it said that Angeli had actually left a note in the Senate chambers on Vice President Pence's desk. The note said, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." He since told the FBI that that Mike Pence is a child trafficking traitor. Can you show that picture one more time? This picture is quite literally one for the history books. It is. So many people believe when our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandchildren look in their history books and they read about January 6, 2021, this will be one of the pictures in there. Now, Mr. Angeli will have to face the consequences for his actions, no matter what those are, but the point is clear. The voices you listen to, the stories we believe, the moral universe you embrace, it matters. One more picture for you. This is a picture of Pastor C, we'll call him. Picture's blurred out. His head is cut off in the picture. All you can see is that he's sitting on his floor reading his Bible. And the reason why the picture's blurred is because Pastor C ministers in a part of the world where Christians face great persecution. Now, Pastor C works alongside one of our amazing global partners here in Northeast, Never Thirst. What an amazing group they are. We are so thankful to support their work around the globe. Basically, what Never Thirst does is they organize with pastors like Pastor C, and they bring clean water into developing communities that don't have access to it otherwise. And the reason why they partner with pastors or with churches is because they want to give these pastors a platform through clean water to tell their communities about the living water of Jesus Christ. Now, Pastor C was located in a community that was hostile towards Christianity. Very few Christians there. Strong, sort of militant Hindu village. And his Hindu neighbors wanted him out. But Pastor C continued to preach, to share the good news of the gospel. So they poisoned his two sons, 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and killed them. Now, I don't know what you would do if your pastor C in that moment, but for me, that might be a good sign. Dust the dirt off my sandals and move out of town, right? But not Pastor C. He stayed and he preached because he felt called by God there. So they escalated to the next level. They put guards at the local watering hole, which was a contaminated well. They did not have access to clean water there. And they wouldn't let any of the Christians, Pastor C included, come and get water there in order to run him out. But even still, Pastor C stayed and he preached. Now, it wasn't long after that that Pastor C heard about what Never Thirst did. And he partnered with Never Thirst in order to bring a clean water well to the community. And when he did, not only did he forgive those who murdered his sons and denied them water, but he welcomed all the people in the community to get water at the new well. This is what Pastor C said. He said, "Despite all discrimination and persecution I have faced, I have forgiven my persecutors. I have gratitude towards the Lord, and I welcome all to get safe drinking water from this well." Since the well was planted, 5 families in Pastor C's community has come to know the Lord. Praise God for that. But I gotta ask you, what compels a man and his wife to stay and preach and share and forgive and love. The voices that you listen to, the stories we believe, the moral universe we embrace, it matters. And you know this. I know this. We know this. We know this because we can sense that there's something deeply wrong in our culture today. Never in our lifetimes have we seen politics able to control and divide and provoke worship. You've sensed how addicted you can be to your screens, to your phones, and you don't like that about you. You don't like that about your kids. You've seen the diabolical nature of targeted ads, and you're probably exhausted like me with the constant onslaught of messaging. There's a still small voice inside of you that says, I don't want to be addicted anymore. I don't want to be anxious anymore. I don't want to be controlled. There's a small voice inside of us all that says there's something wrong with this, and we must resist. But how? How? The answer is really actually quite simple. Stop listening to the voices of this world and start listening to the voice of God. Now again, I'll remind you, in week 3 and 4 of the series, we're gonna come back, we're gonna talk about how to listen to the voice of God. Next week, I'm encouraging you to come back. We're gonna talk about how to discern truth and falsity and the voices of this world. But this week, one last time, I want to challenge you to a moment of reflection. What voices are you listening to? In fact, here's your homework this week. This week, I want you to go home and I want you to do a voice audit. A voice audit. What's a voice audit, Tyler? Well, I've made a little diagram for you. I want you to go home. I want you to rip out a sheet of paper. And I want you to write down the day of the week. And I want you to do this at least 2 days. Okay? You need to do it on a normal weekday and a normal weekend day. I'd prefer if you do it every day. If you do it every day, it'll actually be a disruptive spiritual practice for you this week that might lead to self-revelation, confession, repentance, and life changes, what we're after here. But at least one weekday and at least one weekend day, I want you to do an audit of the voices in your life. And I just want you throughout the day to record what voices you're listening to and how often. And then maybe at the end of the day or the next morning, I want you to sit down and I want you to ask yourself, what stories are they teaching me? What moral universe is it leading me to embrace? What is it telling me about what's right and wrong? What are these telling me about what's broken in the world and the solutions for it? What are these voices telling me about human life and human flourishing and my purpose here? What voices am I listening to and how are they shaping me? For those interested, right now our chat hosts are gonna put a link in the chat for you where you can access a PDF where we've created a really simple worksheet for you this week as you journey with your groups and as you journey with your family. But I would encourage you, do a voice audit this week and come back next week ready to lean further in. All right, I'll close with you today by saying this. Bottom line, in a church like ours, we have a lot of diverse political perspectives, a lot of diverse cultural backgrounds. We have lots of diverse stories that we bring with us into this family that have raised us and reared us and shaped us over time. But in the church, all of those other stories must surrender to the one great story of our King Jesus. And we must speak the truth in love to one another, holding each other accountable when any of the alternative voices of this world take precedence over the voice of God, and we must lock arms together and tune in to his voice so we can get the marching orders of the King for his kingdom. So in the same way that we began, I want to end again today by getting a fresh word from the voice of God, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 14. Again, this is a letter from Paul to the church in Ephesus. Paul writes, "We must no longer be children, tossed to and fro, blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from who the whole body, joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth and building itself up in love. This is the word of the Lord, the voice of God. Thanks be to God for his word.